Hello and welcome to the Psych Files, brought to you by the Psych Files mobile apps, Psych Explorer and Psych Test Hero. Get the Psych Explorer app to help you stay on top of what's happening now in the field of psychology. The most credible bloggers, podcasters, videos, and tweets from psychologists around the world in one app, Psych Explorer. And if you're taking a psychology class, do pick up Psych Test Hero. Hundreds of psychology terms all laid out in concept maps with brief audio definitions and practice quizzes. The only psychology apps created and maintained by me, psychologist, teacher, and lifelong learner, Michael Britt. Welcome to episode 173, where I think you're going to find this very interesting. We're going to try to answer the question of whether or not you can see into the future, or maybe be influenced by the future. This has been a big topic ever since last year when well-known psychologist Daryl Bem published a paper in well-known journal called the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology, a very long article in which he demonstrated that he had found support for some forms of psychic ability. Big news. I mean, you know, there are journals that will report results of studies in parapsychology, but they typically don't make it into the journals that are backed by, the American Psychological Association, the Association for Psychological Science, the journals that most psychologists submit their research to. I have an interview today with Stuart Ritchie, and he replicated this very well-known study, one of BEM's 9 studies, actually, that make up this original research that was published last year. So in the course of this interview, you'll hear Stuart Ritchie talk about the original BEM study. And he met with BEM and borrowed some of his equipment and used the same or almost nearly the same methodology and materials and tried to replicate this to see if he could find support for this psychic ability. A lot of talk now about replication. The fact that many scientists, many fields of science, don't do enough replication. Some political reasons for that. Replicating a study, I mean, it's not as exciting as the original study, but it is supposed to be the hallmark of good science. In fact, one of the problems with this so-called Mozart effect, which I addressed in an earlier episode, so I recommend you go take a look at that. Just do a search on Mozart on the website, www.thepsychfiles.com. And there's a two-parter on that whole thing. And one of the problems was that the only people who could find support for a Mozart effect are the people who originally did the study on the Mozart effect, right? And that's a problem. Knowledge should not be contained in one person's head, right? Everyone should be able to find, if there really is something there, then people should be able to replicate it, people anywhere in the world. So, very important that we do replications. And here's the first one. And this one also has a little bit of controversy to it. First off, Stuart Ritchie, lead author, Richard Wiseman, who you may know online, he has a very famous video in which he does a card trick and then changes some of the colors of the clothes that they're wearing and stuff like that, just to show how much we don't pay attention to what's going on around us. So Richard Wiseman, Christopher French. So Stuart Ritchie is from the University of Edinburgh in the UK. Richard Wiseman, University of Hertfordshire, Hatfield, United Kingdom again. And Christopher French, Animalistic Psychology Research Unit, Goldsmiths, University of London. So we have a wonderful British accent. So very interesting guy, Stuart Ritchie. He has a blog. It's called Time Out of Mind, A Skeptical Psychology Student Raises an Eyebrow. And so that's timeoutofmindblog.wordpress.com, and I'll have a link to that from the website. A little information about him from his About page. He's a PhD psychology student in the psychology department, University of Edinburgh, as I mentioned, whose research focuses on really a lot of different things. One of them is memory. So what can educational interventions do to improve memory? He also has a secondary interest in other areas, like the psychology of the paranormal. Really interesting guy who's doing some neat research and knows some really good people, as I mentioned, Richard Wiseman and Christopher French. So what BEM did to stir the world of psychology was, this, as I mentioned, a study in psychic phenomenon. Kind of hard to understand. The paper itself is very long. It's one paper that contains 9 studies. And he did a couple of different things, and the replication that Ritchie and his colleagues did focused on the final study, okay, which was the strongest one. What kind of psychic ability is this? It's sort of like precognition, but not quite. You know, so precognition, you know, the ability to see the future. So it's not quite that. It's not Nostradamus, for example. So, you know, most people know about Nostradamus. He made all these extremely vague predictions about the future back in the 1500s. And my cat is walking all over my computer. If you were to look at the things that Nostradamus said, they can be interpreted in a variety of ways, as many people have done, to try to show that he predicted everything, you know, the world wars and fall of the towers, the Twin Towers in New York. I mean, you know, all kinds of things, you know. But if you look deeper into them, you find a couple things. Some of them are hoaxes. Others are, again, so vague that they really don't make, you know, you sort of have to really got to read into them to believe that there's something there. So as psychologists, as scientists, we can't make vague predictions. We have to make specific ones. And that actually was the one of the things that I addressed in a very early episode called Predictions, Predictions. And I talk about how important it is to have very specific predictions. So the way that BEM went about this may sound a little bit bizarre, but let me give you a brief overview of what he tried to do to take this idea of, can we be influenced by the future, and bring it into the lab. Okay, so what he does is this. He brings subjects into the lab. There's a number of different studies, but I'll focus on the 9th one. Sits them down in front of a computer. And he's had this computer program written. And it looks a lot like a memory test, right? And we psychologists are famous for memory tests, right? Very famous for bringing people in and giving them lists of words and asking them to memorize them. So it looks a lot like that. You sit down, you get a computer program that presents to you 48 words, some common, some not so common. They're words like a hamburger and a carpenter and clothes like suspenders. All right, so they're in different categories. There's 4 categories of words. Some of them are foods, others are occupations, some are animals, and some are clothes. Right, so they fall into those categories. So you sit down and you see each word for 3 seconds. And then the word goes away and there's a 1 second pause. And then you see the next word for 3 seconds, right? And you're tested all by yourself, very quiet room. Experimenter just comes in, starts up the computer, and leaves the room. Okay, and you'll hear about why that was done in part so that to minimize any experimenter effects. Now, after you see these 48 words, you are then given a memory test. All right, so you're asked, okay, now try to remember as many of those words as you can, and then just type them here into this box on the computer screen. And we'll give you 5 minutes to just dump them out there. You know, how many can you remember from that list of 48? Now, first off, the first thing you might be curious about is that most people were able to accurately recall around 10 words, which is, you know, if I had to guess, I would guess that they remembered about the first couple and then the last few, you know, and then made guesses in between. And that's a common sort of thing, right? Recency and primacy effects, we call those. But anyway, most people remember about 10 out of these 48 words. Okay, so you type in your words and you have 5 minutes and you're trying to come up with them. Then there's one final piece to the study, now that you have taken the memory test, which is this. The computer randomly chooses 24 out of these 48 words. And gives them to you again. So here are 24 of those original 48 words. What we'd like you to do now is just to categorize these words. Is it a food? Is it an occupation? Is it an animal? Article of clothing? And just type the word into this box over here, whatever category you think it is. We'll see how this is used in just a second, but it's an opportunity to get you interacting with a randomly chosen subset out of those 48. Now, here's what we're looking for. We want to know if those original 10 or so words, did a surprisingly large number of them wind up in this later practice test that the computer randomly chose? So in other words, you saw 48, you remembered about 10, and then you saw another 24. Well, wouldn't it be unusual if the 10 that you remembered, a lot of them came from this list of 24 that you had a chance to play around with again that were randomly chosen by the computer? You know, that's why it's called retroactive facilitation of recall. In other words, is there some phenomenon going on here in which the future, in which the computer chose these 24 words, somehow influenced you in the past, right? Or we could say it this way. Were you influenced by a future event you hadn't experienced yet, which is this exposure to these 24 words? And that exposure in the future caused you to remember more of them. I hope you're following this. I tell you, I had to look at this a number of times and say, all right, so in other words, I get these, I'm being influenced by the future in which a computer randomly chooses words that I get to look at again. And that future event influences my present. Okay, I think I get that. So, and that's why, you know, again, it's sort of like, well, I don't know, if you were going to try to test psychic ability, I don't know if you'd go about it this way. But remember that if we found that, and that is what Bem found, okay? He found that, you know, statistically speaking, participants did seem to remember an unusually larger number of these future words when they were asked to simply recall as many as they could from the original 48. Now, as you'll hear Richie say, Stuart Richie, in just a second, I promise to get to the interview, as you'll hear him say, it is interesting. But there are a number of issues with what Bem did. The first one, though, is that by unusual, we're talking about 53% of these randomly chosen future words versus 47% of the words that weren't on the list or words that weren't chosen. Is it a huge effect? You know, in other words, of the 10 words, are all 10 of those on this future test? No. Are 80% of them on the future test? No. So you could at first just say, well, I forget this. I mean, this isn't even a very big effect, you know. But you could argue, well, if enough people find it, other than Daryl Bem, if it consistently comes up, boy, that's interesting. And it does kind of argue for some phenomenon we don't really understand. And that's what science is about, and that is what Stuart Ritchie has done and his colleagues. Let me get straight to the interview, and then I'll have some final comments. Just one word about the interview. Stuart was in a room with a very tall ceiling, and so there's a lot of echo. It's a little bit hard in the beginning to understand, but it does come in, and you know, hopefully you will be able to pick this up and go with it. He has a lovely accent, so it was really fun talking to him, as you'll see. But the reverb, you know, the echo, makes it a little bit hard in places to understand exactly what he said. But you'll get it, and I think you'll have fun with it. All right, so to the interview. Stuart, to give the audience a good background, can you tell us about the Daryl Bem study? Now, I know he's been interested in parapsychology for a number of years, but this is the first big study, and certainly in a well-known psychology journal, that published an article supporting some facet of parapsychology. So can you explain what he did?
Sure, absolutely. Daryl Bem has had a paper in that Psych Bulletin, which is one of the very top journals in psychology, not just social psychology. In 1994, he had an article with, I believe, meta-analysis. It wasn't original research, but this is the first article that had original research, which Bem claims to show psychic powers, or psi, as it's called in parapsychology. And of course, this stuff has been going on in parapsychology journals. It's just been going on the whole time. Every issue of the Journal of Parapsychology and the Journal of the Society for Psychical Research has more and more and more evidence of that they claim, at least, of psychic powers. But this was the first time that, as far as I'm aware, this sort of evidence was in a mainstream journal of the original data. And so what Professor Bem did, he took lots and lots of effects that we, as psychologists, use all the time, like priming, habituation, memory tests, practice facilitating recall, I should say. And he reversed them. So the effect came before the cause. So he put the causes at the end of the experiment instead of at the start. He actually went on to the Colbert report.
No kidding, I didn't hear that. So he was on Colbert?
That's right. He was on the Colbert Report, and he was talking about time-traveling pornography, which was the first experiment he did, which is where participants were shown two curtains on a computer screen. They were told that one of those curtains had a picture behind it, and the other one didn't. They then had to click. They just had to click the one that they thought a picture was behind. Right? And, of course, what you would expect is participants would get it 50-50.
Right.
You know, they have a 50-50 chance to click the one that had a picture behind it. But, in fact, they had a 53.1% chance to choose a picture when one of the pictures was an erotic picture. The 50% of the time when it was normal pictures of, you know, a flower or something, but if it was a picture of a naked person or something like that, then they got it more often than chance.
But that doesn't sound terribly impressive, 53 versus 47%?
So it's not a massive effect size, certainly, but it is statistically significant in the sample that Ben used. And he also showed that people significantly avoid when there's a negative picture, so a picture of someone getting stabbed or something, they click the other side that doesn't have the picture on it. The point here was that the computer only chose which curtain had a little picture behind it after the participant had clicked on which one they chose, a future event.
Oh, I see.
So Ben explained this as being, we maybe evolved to predict erotic stimuli in the future and avoid dangerous things. And they're about the same sort of effects. And they're both statistically significant. And as I say, there are 9 experiments in this paper. 8 of those experiments were significant.
Huh. He thinks that we evolved to be able to predict sexual events in the future?
There's only a very, you know, a couple of lines of that in his paper, but he tries to give a sort of theoretical explanation of what's going on, and that's one of his interpretations, is that, well, you know, we've certainly evolved to have an appreciation to approach erotic stimuli. You know, people are, as we know, all very excited about erotic stimuli, and he says that this extends into the future as well, for erotic stimuli that we have not yet seen.
Interesting. So you're looking at two curtains. You pick one, but the computer has not yet selected which one actually has the erotic image behind it.
When you see the curtains, you're reaching forward in time to how you will feel in a few seconds, and you're getting some kind of erotic feeling from the future, and that's going back to influence your behavior when you're choosing the picture. So this is the reason this paper was called Feeling the Future. You're getting these feelings backwards in time from the future.
Now, was this the article that came out last year, or is this just previous research you're talking about here?
No, this is actually the article that came out last year in the GPSP.
So it was part of his 9, because his one article had 9 studies.
They're actually quite diverse, the 9 experiments. So the one that we replicated that we'll talk about later on was a memory test, nothing to do with erotic stimuli or anything like that. But yeah, so you have these quite diverse experimental paradigms.
Yeah, so I remember when I was reading this, I thought, okay, so basically he's showing people words and asking them to recall them. And I thought, well yeah, okay, that is a pretty very common way to test subjects for memory and all kinds of other things. It's easy to do. So go ahead and tell us. But his twist on it is what?
So the last two experiments 8 and 9, were on facilitation of recall, which is, as you say, a standard thing that psychologists do. If you see a list of words, and then you see some of those words again, you're going to remember the ones that you've seen twice better than the ones that you've only seen ones.
Mm-hmm.
You don't even have to be a psychologist to know that.
Right.
But what Professor Ben did, he put that little extra practice period after the memory test. So what happens is, you see the words, in this case there were 48 words, very standard words like onion and carpenter, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then you had a free recall test. And this was a surprise to the participants. They weren't told it was a memory test. But it popped up with boxes on the screen where you would type in all the words that you could remember. So free recall.
Mm-hmm.
And then, only then, the computer randomly selects 24 of those 48 words to be practice words. So they're called practice words from now on. And the other 24 are the control words. They're discarded. They're never seen again.
Okay.
But just so they see these practice words again, they pop up again on the screen, so you get this extra practice at them. And then you have to do a set of exercises where you type the words into the screen and you click them and highlight them. So you're really getting a lot of practice of these words. They're getting from them to your memory. But the interesting thing is, you've already done the memory test,
mm-hmm.
right? So what Ben apparently found, what he showed in this paper, was that his participants were able to remember these practice words significantly more often than they were able to remember the control words. Or I should say, they were able to remember significantly more practice words than they were control words. So that is, mm-hmm. you've studied for an exam, you've sat the exam, it's all done, you're walking out, and then you pick up your books again and study a little bit more, and it turns out that study, after the exam's finished, has improved your grade on the exam that you just
did. Oh, that's an interesting idea for students then. They should study yeah. for a test, and then after they walk out, they should study again.
That would be the interpretation. Obviously, that's not exactly what Ben showed. It's just memory for words. But mm-hmm. you know, if this effect works, then you would expect that you'd be able to do that with exams too.
But if I study again after I took the test, and believe me, I watch Fringe, one of my favorite shows. So I'm very into fringy stuff. But anyway. But, you know, also a scientist. So I take a test, and then I walk out. I go back to my dorm room, and I study the book again. But the assumption is that in me studying it again, I would have to have influenced the professor in the making of the test. But the test was made maybe a week ago.
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously, this is taking it into a sort of a practical, you know, scenario that the Benham experiment doesn't quite go into.
Okay.
But what's happening is that that again, just like the erotic stimuli behind the curtains, when you do your test mm-hmm. For the erotic stimuli, just clicking one, or for the memory test, putting in your words, the computer hasn't yet chosen what the words are going to be.
Mm-hmm.
So you're actually predicting a future event. You're predicting which words are going to be shown to you by the computer randomly. It really is a future experiment. Like pretty much all the experiments in the paper, it's pretty simple. It's mm-hmm. you know, once you get your head around the sort of weird retro causality, mm-hmm. it's quite simple as experiments go.
There's
not a lot of room for alternative explanations, I don't think. I can't think of anything that would really bias that, as long as the random number generator is really generating random numbers.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I can't see any major problems with the actual procedure itself.
Yeah, I agree. I guess the simplicity of it is maybe a good thing.
I think that was Ben's objective for the whole paper, actually. He actually says, a lot of parapsychology is done on quite esoteric areas. Mm. So you know, a lot of this stuff is quite bizarre. So Ben actually explicitly said, I'm going to do very simple experiments using very simple statistics, and I'm going to try and convince the world, the skeptical world, that something's happening here. And so that was, I think, part of his modus operandi on this paper.
You no doubt have heard of the amazing Randy Howe. I think since the early 70s, he's had this challenge that if you could prove under scientific conditions that there any of this phenomenon actually works, there's like, I don't know, maybe $1 million prize. Has Ben applied for that prize?
I don't know what's happened in the past. I know that Ben has had sort of run-ins with the skeptic community, as they're known. People like James Randi. James Randi is one of the sort of figureheads of the skeptic community. You have things like Skeptic in the Pub, which I believe is cropping up all over America. It's quite a big thing here in the UK.
Skeptics in the Pub?
Skeptics in the Pub, yeah. So you go to the pub and you have a talk. A sort of skeptical speaker who's talking about maybe alternative medicine one day, and then maybe you'll have a speaker talking about parapsychology another day. Maybe you'll have someone talking about UFOs from a sort of skeptical angle.
Interesting.
And he's had this $1 million challenge for a long time. time. It's kind of a, it's almost like a rhetorical thing that the $1 million comes, because I'm quite sure that people have applied for it and they've been unable to, I don't know, contact the dead or whatever they claim to be doing. Mm. But it's not really a scientific way of doing things, because a scientific way of doing things is, as you know, writing papers up and publishing them in scientific journals when they've been peer-reviewed and so on. So I'm not that comfortable with the $1 million prize as it is. You know, I'm broadly on the side of Jane Randi, and I'm quite sceptical of paranormal powers and forces and all that sort of stuff. But I'm not sure the $1 million prize is the way to go.
Okay. All right. But in any case, so he's successful. He submits this to the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology, and it is published. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, it was peer-reviewed and then revised the paper, I'm sure, in the light of what the reviewer said. And it was all above board. It's published in the same way as any article would be published. In fact, I think it actually got more peer review than you would normally get. You know, you'd normally send off to maybe two or three reviewers, but I think this was sent to maybe four or five, mainly because it was A, controversial, and B, 9 studies. So there's a lot of stuff to look at.
Yeah, yeah, it's a huge article, very long.
Yeah, it's a long read.
Mm-hmm.
So the editor published a little editorial comment along with it saying, we know that some people might find this shocking and so on, but we think it's interesting. Mm. And we also published a critique piece along with it. And we hope that in the future people will replicate the study and discuss it and debate it and so on. So I think, you know, it's a very sort of open-minded and commendable thing to do, I think, to go out on a limb like that and publish a study that ordinarily people would look at and discard just for being anything to do with parapsychology.
And I applaud them for encouraging replications, and we'll get to yours in just a second. So I guess I could see how someone might read it and say, well, it's a fairly simple study, and he has found significant results. So I can see maybe how someone would pass it along and say, well, then let's publish it. So the critiques came out afterwards, and what can you tell us about what people said?
There are two really good critiques. Professor Ben put up his article once it had been accepted. He put it online before it was actually, you know, published in print. And so, you know, there was a bit of skeptical. People read it and wrote responses to it before it was even appeared in print. So James Alcott wrote a very long critique where he pointed out various things, various methodological issues here and there with the paper. And another one is a really good article by Tal Yarkoni, if I think is how you pronounce it. I think he's at Boulder, Colorado. He's a postdoc in the psychology department.
I'll link to those from my website.
Right, yeah. Well, he's a piece of blog called Citation Needed, you know, like on Wikipedia. He wrote a really long and really good critique where he points out things like Ben's sample size is not always the same in all his experiments. So, for instance, in experiments 8 and 9, he has one study that's 100 participants, which has a significant result, and another study which is 50 participants, that has a significant result. But in a previous experiment, he has 150 participants, and that's a significant result. So what Yarkoni suggests is that Ben has been sort of lumping together and splitting experiments. If he finds a significant effect in 100 people, that's fine, he counts that as a separate experiment. If he finds it in 50 people, that's fine, he counts as a separate experiment. But if he doesn't find it in 100, he thinks, well, I'll just add another 50 to it, and maybe that'll make it a significant result, and then I'll publish that as 150 participant experiment. And so this is not the way, really, that we should be doing research. You know, I'm not saying that Ben has done this, but this is kind of suggestive of the fact. Another thing which is pointed out in the critiques is that the effect size of the experiments is negatively related to the sample size. So again, there's more evidence that, you know, if you find a big effect in a small sample, you just stop there, that's fine.
Mm-hmm.
But if you don't seem to find this effect, you just add on a few more participants. And Ben seems to have done this in blocks of 50, so it's his experiments are either 50, 100, or 150.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not as if he's just said, well, just run three more and see if that makes it. You know, so he has added an extra block on it if he's done this. So it's not as bad as it could have been. But it's not the best way of going about it.
So one of the recommendations has been, and was it you who called this optional stopping?
We quote in our paper a paper by Eric Jan Wagenmakers, which we'll talk about in just a second, noted that this effect size thing is evidence of optional stopping, which is also the kind of the nice way of putting it. But the other way of putting it is data peaking. You peek at your data and you say, well, it's not quite significant, so we'll run a couple more participants and see what happens there.
Mm-hmm.
And really what you should be doing is saying, we're going to run 100 participants. We've written this down before we do the experiment. You know, this is completely, you know, a bit like when pharmaceutical companies run, they have to register their big trials that they do. So they say, we're going to run 2,000 people, they're all going to, you know, 1,000 of them are going to get a drug, 1,000 of them are going to get a placebo, and, you know, we're going to go on from there. And so they can then say, well, in our experiment, 2,000 took the drug and 1,000 took placebo. You know, you would know then that something funny had happened and they changed the parameters of the experiment. So what you should be doing is saying, I'm going to run 100 participants in this experiment, and that's it.
Mm-hmm.
It's not there. If we don't find an effect, then we don't find an effect. And that's a sort of one of the recommendations that's kind of
That's a key one. Other major critiques?
So there are some issues to do with the statistics that them used. So, for instance, all the way through the paper, he used some one-tailed t-tests. So t-tests were used in this paper because they're very, very simple. And as I said, them is wanting to really use nothing that's really complicated. So people could say, well, you just obscured stuff by using arcane statistical techniques. So he's using these very simple techniques, but he's using one-tailed t-tests. And they're normally only used when you're doing a confirmatory experiment.
Right.
So, you know, you're running something that exact experiment's been run before, and you can expect an effect in a particular direction, and so you double your chances of finding an effect. And so it's not clear that them is really allowed to use one-tailed t-test because they do inflate the chances of getting false positive results. What Ben would say is that, well, there's all this research in parapsychology published in the parapsychology journals that would suggest that I can predict an effect in this direction.
Mm-hmm.
But what I would say is, you're trying to, this paper is almost like a sort of starting from scratch. You're trying to convince us all that there's something happening here. Mm-hmm. Shouldn't you just be as conservative as possible?
Right, yeah.
And so actually, if you use two-tailed t-tests, which are the sort of, you know, the no, not particularly any direction prediction results, several of them results would not be significant, at least a couple.
And what about the issue of inflating alpha? I mean, you can't just run 50 t-tests, right? I mean, something's going to come out.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. So this is what James Alcock, in his critique, he talks about multiple comparisons and how he's tested lots and lots and lots of t-tests. Yeah. Well, so if you're interested in that particular debate, Alcock says it better than I could, and then Ben actually responds as well. So I can give you the link to that.
Yeah, so how does he respond? I mean, we can go on. I don't want to go on too long with all the critiques, because there's plenty of them, unless you think there's another key one that we should talk about, because I would like to hear he responded to these critiques.
He essentially says, you know, even if we did correct for multiple comparisons, we'd still find significant effects in these experiments.
Okay.
So there's really that, I mean, I don't want to just read out what he's written, but I think he's fairly confident that even if, you know, that even if this was a problem, he would still have found significant results.
Let's go to your study. So you decided to replicate his 9th study.
Sure. So essentially, in experiment 9, you're getting more post-test practice of the works. Ben found that this effectively doubled the effect size. There didn't seem to be any major issues with analysis of it, or the setup of it, or any of that. That's the main reason that we selected. If any of these experiments was going to replicate, it was going to be the one with the big effect. Well, so what we thought we would do, this is myself at the University of Edinburgh, and Richard Wiseman at the University of Hertfordshire, Chris French at Goldsmiths College at the University of London. I know Richard from this Skeptics in the Pub thing that I mentioned. He's often talking at Skeptics in the Pub, and I was chatting to him at the end of one of the Skeptics in the Pub events that he has spoken at. And I said, have you seen this new paper that's come out with Daryl Bem? I said, it's come out with experiments, and it seems pretty solid, and it seems pretty impressive. And Richard said, let's replicate it.
So
we got in touch, and it was as simple as that. And we got in touch with Chris, who's also interested in these things, and we got together and we thought we would do 3 independent replications at each of our universities, using exactly the same materials. So another point in favour of Bem. By the way, I met last year, and he's very, very friendly and very, very pleasant.
Yeah, you mentioned in your article that you contacted him. He gave you many of the same materials, words.
So Jim has actually put them online. He's put the package that you need to replicate the experiments. Mm-hmm. And so this is, another, as I say, another point in his favor.
Okay.
He's very, very, he's very, very happy to facilitate people to replicate the experiments. So we did that, but we changed a couple of the words to make sort of anglicized, to make them in British English rather than American English. The word yogurt is spelled differently, you know, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But really, the vast majority of words are exactly the same.
I had to say, that's where I got a laugh. You, the words, some of them were what jockstrap, and you changed that to thong.
Yeah, we thought it might work. We were worried that people in the UK might not know what jockstrap is.
And you changed pantyhose to tights.
Yeah.
What's a waistcoat again?
A waistcoat would be like a sort of a blazer jacket thing. So I think we changed. one of the problems was Ben had suspenders,
which
in American English is, of course, the thing you use to hold up your trousers.
Right.
But in British English is lingerie, you know, ladies. And so we thought, well, we could change it to braces, which is our word for the things you use to hold up your trousers.
Right.
But braces, of course, is also what you put in your teeth.
Right.
So we thought we'll just use an entirely different word. Let's just use waistcoat. And we made sure that these words all had the same frequency in the language, using the same source that Ben used to look at the frequency of the words in the language as the ones he had used.
All right. Careful attention to the wordage, okay?
Even though we did pay careful attention to the words, if the random number generator is true, then there shouldn't be a problem with any of this. You know? Although there are issues, of course, with some words are more easy to remember than others. Mm. But again, over a lot of participants and over a lot of random selections of those words, it probably shouldn't be that much of a problem. But we did our best to pick words that were relatively similar and or similar frequency.
Okay.
So we advertised in a similar way to Ben. So Ben had posters up around his university saying, "Are you Sidekick? Contact this researcher who's doing the experiment." So we had those same things.
Why not just say it's a memory experiment? Why tell people that you're looking for psychic phenomenon?
Well, yeah, so this is the problem. We've not actually written about this, but it's a problem I've been thinking about. A couple of the reviews of our article said that, well, did the participants know it was about psychic powers? Maybe they're going to act differently if they know it's about psychic powers than they would if they were just, you know, doing a standard psychology experiment.
Mm.
And maybe that would affect their performance in some way, because we know that there is evidence that the way people expect an experiment to go, the expectations they have, can affect their performance on it, especially on things like memory tests.
Mm.
But our response to that is, well, you know, this is what Ben did. He did exactly the same thing. We told them up front this experiment. And in fact, we couldn't have even changed this, because Ben's computer program, the first screen pops up and says, this experiment test for ESP. So we had to use the same thing. And of course, we wanted to make our replication as exact as possible.
All right.
So we, as I say, ran 50 participants each, so exactly the same number of participants as were in Ben's original experiment. A month or so, a couple months to run on these participants. I ran all my participants in Edinburgh, myself, Richard and Chris got their research assistants to run their participants. So actually, Richard and Chris, who are known as kind of skeptics of the psychic power, we ran these three experiments and we found absolutely nothing. So all of our, each of our replications were null results. The participants remembered exactly the same number of control words as they did practice words. Mm-hmm. Not exactly the same, but, you know, not statistically significantly different number of practice words than control words.
And let me ask you why there's a tiny piece in here about this stimulus seeking scale. Why is this even in here? What is this?
Well, this is one of the criticisms we give in our article of Ben, is that there's actually quite a lot of stuff in that experiment that Ben sort of correlates with psychic powers and so on, or attempts to correlate with psychic powers. The stimulus-seeking one is the only one he reports in the paper. Stimulus-seeking has been associated with increased psychic performance in some previous parapsychological experiments. There are experiments published in these journals that very few people look at, sadly, that say that stimulus-seeking is associated with increased psychic powers. So Ben put in a couple of stimulus-seeking questions. It's a questionnaire that's made up of two questions. It hasn't been validated, the reliability hasn't been tested, and it really was just a sort of almost an afterthought.
But this was another critique he got, right? That you can't do a study on one thing and then throw in, let's say, a bunch of personality scales just because maybe they might have something to do with it, and then later on pick out and only mention the ones that were significant. You have to have a good reason for measuring those personality variables. They have to be related, and you have to report how every single one of them came out. Okay, go ahead.
So once you actually look at the materials that Ben used, there are actually quite a few things that he asked participants about that are not reported in the paper. So he asked participants about transliminality, which is something in the parapsychological literature about how close you are to your dreams and how close you are to other states of reality and things like that. He also talked about test anxiety. There's a question about how nervous are you when you take a test. There's also a question about, do you ever do any meditation or biofeedback and things like that. And so you start to think, well, how many questions is he asking here? And how many of these did he test? Mm-hmm. And if he had found that these were significantly associated with psychic powers, would he have included them in the paper?
Yeah, right.
You do wonder at that point. But who knows? You know, he did consistently find across the experiments that stimulus-seeking was related. I think pretty much all the experiments that stimulus-seeking participants were able to perform better.
All right, so did you think, okay, let's submit this to the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology?
Yes, we thought, well, they've put in a thing saying, right? Please let us replicate this study. And so we sent it to them because we thought, well, they'd be interested in how the effects that they have published have gone.
Okay, I agree.
Yeah, of course, sure.
But what happened?
Well, unfortunately, they were not interested. We got an email back from the editor, Elliot Smith, who was very, very polite, very pleasant, and said, look, the policy at JPSP is, unless you have gone beyond, unless you have replicated the result and then extended it into a new dimension, you've done something different, you've maybe done it in a different set of participants, or you've changed some aspect of the experimental methodology, we're not interested. We're not interested in straight replications.
So at that point, you pointed to last year's editorial and said, yeah, but you said, or the previous editor said, we encourage you to replicate this.
Yeah, exactly, we did. And we said, when something's as controversial as this, you don't want to just say, well, okay, we'll take that basic effect and put it in a different situation and see if we find an effect. No, what you want to do is see if you can find exactly that finding again in an independent lab. Mm-hmm. Richard has written about this in parapsychology before, that parapsychologists will often, or at least in Richard's opinion, parapsychologists will often try to move the goalposts a little bit. So maybe if an experiment that's been done with pictures finds a psychic effect, and then some other people do it with little videos, and they don't find an effect, the original people will say, hey, well, you didn't do it with pictures, there's a difference. So,
right.
You know.
Right.
So really what you really want is exact replications. And so we sent that to the editor, and the editor again said, no, sorry, we're just not interested, it's not happening. What we would be interested in, the editor said, to be fair, we'd be interested in a meta-analysis. You know, if several people, or maybe do over 20 studies of these effects, then we'd be interested. And of course, you know, I can see why they would say something like that, because we only replicated one of these experiments, or we only failed to replicate one of these experiments. Mm-hmm. There are 9 of them in the paper. You know, it's 3 times we replicated it, but there's plenty of space for other people to do replications. So, you know, maybe they just aren't interested in single, exact replications.
I don't know how you can say that when the topic is so...
Yeah, sure. Especially in the age now where journals don't have to worry about paper and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. All they have to worry about is all they have to worry about is getting high quality science in there. So why not just maybe put the abstract or replication attempt in the paper copy and put the paper on your website?
Okay. That would have been a good approach. Now, they've taken a lot of heat for this. I haven't been the only one who's tweeted about them. And this failure to publish your study has, I mean, caused a lot of negative press.
Yeah, I feel guilty about that, to be honest.
So you're not as upset as the people who are all tweeting about JPSP and, you know, losing credibility because of this?
I don't think, you know, JPSP is a really good journal. They've got loads of good stuff in there. It's all very interesting stuff. And they were so pleasant to us. And, you know, they were very kind, and they weren't, you know, snarky or anything when they responded to us. It's hard to feel an enormous amount of animosity. And the thing is, if it was surprising, then maybe I'd be more upset. But I'm not really surprised that big journals like that don't want us to publish replication attempts. I'm not happy about it, but I'm not surprised.
Because
so journals are interested in shocking findings, exciting findings, findings that really move on the field, and they're not necessarily that interested in whether those effects replicate. It takes a long time before journals start to publish.
Right, but I've heard that critique as well. It's almost like our journal articles becoming like blog posts.
Absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely.
They've got these fantastic headlines, but the methodology is weak, and there's a real worry that we're just flooding these journals with poor studies with crazy, great, interesting headlines.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So it's almost as if we had a situation in the UK where papers published, there'd been a murder, and papers published all this stuff about, oh, you know, it was the landlord of the girl who got killed, it was the landlord of her that did it, and they put pictures of him on the front page, went into all this stuff about he was a weird guy, and the people in the community thought he was a strange guy, and all this sort of thing. And then it turned out that it wasn't him, and he was completely acquitted by the police, and it turned out it was someone else. They found that the murderer. And the papers were slightly less, they didn't put it on the front page saying, right. we were wrong. Mm-hmm. So it's just exactly the same to a lesser extent, a far less dangerous extent, I think, in scientific journals. When they say, look, we found a big finding. Oh, you failed to replicate it? I'll take that somewhere else.
So, now, you were able to publish this in an open access, it's called...
Plus One, so it's Public One. Library of Science, it stands for.
Public and, Library of Science, okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's becoming... So there are several PLOS journals. There's PLOS Genetics, PLOS Medicine, and there's PLOS One, which is the kind of the general journal that publishes loads of stuff. And this is almost the future of scientific publishing. The articles are published there, open access for anyone, any member of the public who's not, a subscriber to the journal, mm-hmm. can access. There's an interactive bit on it as well, so you can comment on the article, you can write a little critique of it, and the authors can respond, and they're really trying to open up science.
Yeah,
and
right.
Also, the interesting thing about PLOS One is they will publish a paper if it's rigorously carried out, if the methodology is good, if there's no problems with the way it was conducted, no conflicts of interest, and all that sort of stuff, they'll publish it after peer review. So they do send out everything for peer review, and they do get into the nitty-gritty critiques. We had lots of little problems that we had to sort out in the paper before they would publish it, but the resulting paper is open access, and we thought that was a really nice way of going about things.
Yeah, so it's sort of like research 2.0.
Yeah, almost.
Where you could actually contact the author, much like a blog might, it's, this section over here in your methodology, I think, and then you can respond to that. Yeah.
One thing that the PLOS do as a part of their policy is if you fail to replicate someone's result, they'll contact that person and ask them to comment on the paper. So they asked Daryl Bem.
Okay, good. Yeah, I was going to ask you, did you contact Daryl Bem once this was over and say, Daryl, we were unsuccessful in replicating?
Sorry, Daryl.
Yeah, right.
We did. So actually, we presented our findings at the conference of the Society for Psychical Research, which is a kind of venerable research institution that's gone on since the Victorian times. And there's people who are interested in paranormal and so on. So we went along to this conference.
Oh, and did they throw tomatoes at you?
Well, there were a few funny looks, but Daryl was there.
Okay.
So that's when I met Daryl, and we had a nice chat about the results. So he said, well, the reason I think you've not found a positive result in the experiment is because you're all very skeptical.
No.
Well, dear. We wouldn't want to replicate the experiment unless we were skeptical, right? Yeah. This is kind of the first step in wanting to be interested enough to replicate.
Really? I mean, that's reminiscent of the guy who used to bend the spoons, and if he couldn't bend them, he would say that the energy in the room is too negative.
Well, it's Tinkerbell, isn't it? If you don't believe, then Tinkerbell dies. The Tinkerbell effect.
So he said that, huh?
So he said that, and there are experiments showing, in normal psychology, there are experiments showing that experimental expectations can...
Right,
result.
That's true too.
That's certainly true. However, in this experiment, as I've just talked about, the computer runs everything. I would greet the participant at the door, I would sit them down at the computer, and that'd be it. The computer runs absolutely everything, it scores it itself, it even does a little bit of the analysis itself, so it comes out with the statistics at the end. So really, the experimenter involvement in these experiments is very, very, very minimal. And in fact, Ben talks about that in his paper. So we thought, well, is this really a good explanation? Maybe. So some parapsychologists in the past have suggested that skeptics have some kind of unconscious psychic power that nullifies the psychic power of their participants.
Oh, boy.
Sort of a circular logic going on there. The reason you couldn't find psychic powers is because psychic powers exist. So that was Ben's thing. And he pointed to another couple of replications which he's heard of that are positive, in fact. But they haven't been published yet, so we're not really sure whether they were well carried out or who knows. So we'd have to wait until these have been peer-reviewed and published to really discuss them. But in fact, a lot of the replication tests have been sent to Richard Wiseman, one of my co-authors of the paper, who set up a little trial registry. He said, if anyone is going to replicate these experiments, get in touch with us, we'll register it, and then I'll do a meta-analysis on those results at some point in the future. So Richard's currently writing up a meta-analysis on maybe 6 or 7 different replication attempts.
Oh, okay. Well, that's interesting.
So we'll see how that turns out.
Does he have a website for that, or is that just...
Well, the meta-analysis is not on his website yet.
But I mean...
The trial registry was, if you Google Richard Wiseman Bem trial registry, you'll find it, but that'll come out. I don't know which journal he's aiming it at or where it's going, but...
A couple of questions came from some of psychology discussion lists. And so let me just throw them at you. So this phenomenon, this sort of thing here where a big study gets published because it has significant findings in it, but your study doesn't because it didn't. People are referring to that as the file drawer problem, right? Well, tell us what they mean by that, and what do you think about this issue?
Well, so this is a really big problem in psychology and in science in general, actually. You know, so scientists, when they do an experiment, they will, if they find positive results, they'll write them up and publish them in a journal, and that's great. If they find negative results, well, they might think, well, maybe something went wrong in the experiment. Maybe I wasn't feeling particularly psychic that day, or maybe, you know, whatever happens. maybe we didn't use the right test tubes. And so they just put that in the file drawer with all the stuff they never look at, and it gets closed away, and that's the end of it. Mm-hmm. So there's this idea of there being lots and lots of literature out there that's not been published in journals, but it is showing maybe negative results or maybe some positive results that people didn't want to publish. And of course, that's going to skew our reality, essentially. Right. We get all these positive results published, but we never get a single negative result. We do every so often, but we get far fewer negative results. There have been studies in the psychology literature, we're talking 95% of studies confirm their hypothesis. And this is interesting. We shouldn't expect so many studies to find positive results.
So another, let me just thank the people who I, what would you like me to ask Stuart? Well, I've got him on the line. That would be Michael Palige. I always mispronounce his name. I think he's from New York University, Chris Green, York University, and Gerald Peterson from Saginaw Valley State University. So thanks to them for, and Rick Froman also asked me about that. And what university is he from now? JBU.edu. The other question that they wanted to know was, what do you think? I mean, this controversy has been so big as to have people suggesting that psychologists need to completely change the statistics and include more Bayesian analyses. What are your thoughts on that?
The argument's gone back and forth. I must say, I'm pretty ignorant about Bayesian statistics, but from what I can see, there's a bit of subjectivity involved in analysis. Yeah. So we would say that replication is the most important thing. Rather than changing the way we analyze our results, we should change the way we do our experiments.
Yeah.
We should say, okay, we found this result. It's pretty crazy. It's pretty bizarre, mm-hmm. but we're going to do it again in a different set of participants with the same methodology, and we're going to try to get to find the same result. This is something which Henry Roediger talks about in a really good article on replication in the Association for Psychological Science magazine, The Observer. He had a really good article just a few weeks ago on replication and how he's had problems with, you know, he's found an effect in his memory research, and then he's tried to replicate it and it's fallen apart. And you know, if he had published that original paper, that would have been misleading for the whole literature, because you know, the effect actually isn't real, and maybe it was just an artifact in the original experiment. So we would recommend, going along his lines, maybe editors of journals should be asking, when they see an effect that's kind of interesting, they should say, well, okay, we'll publish this if you can go away again and replicate it. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, this is pretty difficult when you've got maybe a population of a vulnerable population that you're only able to to test once. Mm-hmm. Maybe you've got a longitudinal study where you've collected data at two different time points in a big sample of people, and there isn't a comparable sample to test it in again. But I think, you know, the advice should be, where possible, replicate.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, it sounds like rather than throwing out hypothesis testing, we should just adopt more rigorous methodological approaches.
Absolutely. Sounds good to me. And to take into account all the stuff that we talked about, you know, sample size should be agreed on beforehand and not changed. Mm-hmm. And if you're going to be using one-tailed t-tests and stuff like that, you should really make sure that there is evidence for them. If you're trying to convince people of something that's really, 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 you know, against their intuitions, then you should be as conservative as possible with your hypothesis testing.
Nice. Well, listen, thanks so much. It's really, really interesting conversation. Congratulations on this. So it is in plusone.org, and I'll have links to it. Good stuff. Good conversation that scientists should have. Okay. Well, listen, take care.
Cheers. Bye for now.
So there you go. It is out there for you to decide upon whether or not we have a psychic ability. So it's fairly interesting what Stuart said that Richard Wiseman is doing. He is encouraging anyone who has replicated Behm's study to send him the results, and he will try to do what's called a meta-analysis. Right? He'll try to put all those studies together. One of the important things that I've mentioned before is that we have to We as critical thinkers, scientists, as intelligent folks, we have to look at what does not happen. Again, I'll go back to an example I gave back in, I think, Predictions. If you think about your brother and he calls you on the phone 10 minutes later, does that mean something's going on? Is there some kind of strange phenomenon? If you think about it, think about the number of times that you think about your brother, but he does not call you on the phone. Right? You don't write that down. We do not think about the strange correlation of events that do not occur. But we have to take those into account in order to know if something really is happening. We got to think about what does not happen. Pretty cool. All right. Well, that's today's episode. Hope you enjoyed it. Again, if you get a chance to stop by and check out the apps, Psych Explorer for all the latest news in psychology, and Psych Test Hero if you're studying for a test. The apps help support the podcast. And so if you go in, Psych Test Hero is for both Android and iOS, and Psych Explorer is for now just for iOS devices. So check it out. And if you have it, any of these apps, please go in, give a little review, because that really helps. The reviews give people a sense of, well, okay, other people have purchased it. Here's what they think. So if you do get a chance, please go into iTunes or Android Play and give it a review. I'd really appreciate it. Okay, thanks a lot, and take care.